Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine, and for the next few weeks, we're going to be reading articles from the October 1999 edition of True West, The Legend of the Lost Dutchman, by J. Bernard Stults. In all the tales of the Old West, the legend of the Lost Dutchman mine is the most enduring and one of the few lost gold mine stories that has basis in fact. Much of the legend is based on a misleading article first published by Tom Weeden in his newspaper, the Florence, Arizona, Enterprise in 1910. Unfortunately, most of Weeden's article is fiction, mixed with a sprinkling of half-truths twisted and stretched to make the story more intriguing. To find the truth behind the legend, it's necessary to dig further into the past, to the events behind the mine's discovery. One of the main issues that clouds the Lost Dutchman legend is Weeden's blending of historical fact with the hoax that took place in Arizona at the same time. This has confused and confounded many a teller of the Dutchman tale, and it is necessary to explain it in detail for it to be understood. The Great Peralta Land Grant Hoax. One prevalent factor in the Lost Dutchman legend is that the area in which the mine sits, actually some 3,750 square miles of what is now Arizona, was part of a land grant to a Mexican nobleman, Don Miguel Peralta, by King Ferdinand V of Spain in 1748. This land grant, however, was exposed as an elaborate hoax, having nothing to do with the Lost Dutchman mine or Jacob Waltz, and was detailed by Clarence Buddington Kelland in 1947 in an article in the Saturday Evening Post. The Spanish-Mexican Peralta family was a large one, with numerous members living in California and Arizona. It's documented that in 1865, one Miguel Peralta and his brother Jesus opened a store in the town of Wickenburg, Arizona, near the Vulture Mine discovered by Henry Wickenburg. At Black Canyon, southeast of the territorial capital of Prescott, there were other Peraltas, the head of that clan being another Miguel Peralta, an elderly man given the honorary title of Don by his fellow Mexicans. And there were still other Miguel Peraltas, among them Don Peralta's son. All keep turning up in confusing fashion. It was the elderly Don Miguel Peralta who claimed to be the owner of the grant given him by the Mexican government prior to the Gadsden Purchase and had documents including a cedula on parchment to substantiate his title to an unknown number of acres of Arizona land. Under the arrangement entered into between the United States and Mexico to honor authentic grants of land, it was undoubtedly valuable, but nothing on the scale of what was about to come. George M. Willing Jr., familiarly known as Doc Willing, whose only visible means of support was buying and selling mining claims, appeared in Black Rock one day and immediately sought out Don Miguel. After Willing had satisfied himself that Don Miguel's land grant was indeed genuine, a deal was struck, and the grant was purchased for $300, the papers being signed over by both Don Miguel and his son. The front money was supplied by James Addison Revis of St. Louis, Missouri, who had conceived the hoax in his real estate office in St. Louis in 1872. The great Peralta land grant swindle that followed was to bedevil Arizona territory for the next 20 years and all but succeed. Revis was a prosperous real estate agent, owning several farms, city property, and 1,000 feet of valuable river frontage in St. Louis. The exact details of the agreement between Willing and Revis will never be known, other than the fact that Revis agreed to go to Mexico and settle some debts Willing had contracted in California. After purchasing the original grant, Willing returned to Prescott, Revis agreeing to join him there a few weeks later. It was a closely guarded, covert operation for 10 years, in the course of which hundreds of ancient documents were forged. Others that reposed in the archives of Guadalajara, Mexico, and Mexico City were surreptitiously altered, listing counterfeit family histories of the mythical Peraltas. The extent of the land grant took on astronomical proportions. It was extended to include Phoenix inside its west boundary and eastward past the imaginary line that divides today's Arizona from New Mexico, just missing Silver City in New Mexico and the famous Santa Rita copper mines. To the south, it ran in a straight line to about 25 miles north of Tucson. It was 70 miles from that imaginary line to its northern confines, including not only the Superstition Mountains, but also the towns of Phoenix, Maricopa, Casa Grande, Mesa, Florence, Safford, Globe, Clifton, and a dozen other towns or camps. Through it flowed the Gila River, precious beyond price in a parched land where water spelled the difference between life and death. Included along with the Gila was the greater part of the Salt River Valley and the marvelously rich Silver King Mine, which already had produced better than $20 million in ore. There was a dual purpose to the hoax. If the federal government recognized the validity of the grant, not only would Rivas and Willing acquire a huge amount of valuable land, but no one occupying land within its borders would have title to it until they bought a quitclaim deed from the Peralta Land and Development Company, owned by Rivas, with Willing acting as his front man. The people living in the region saw themselves in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Interestingly, Prescott was not involved geographically, but the members of the town cast their lot with their fellow Arizonans. They didn't like what they were hearing, and they openly warned Willing that if he went through with his scheme to seize the homes and ranches of their friends, he'd be given a good old-fashioned necktie party. Ignoring the threats, Willing went to Yavapai County Courthouse in Prescott and recorded a deed conveying a certain grant of land from a Miguel Peralta. The following morning, he was found at the lodging house of R.E. Elliott, lying face down on his bed. Dead. Commenting on Willing's demise, the Prescott miner speculated that his death had been brought on by exposure and privation. The populace of Prescott happily accepted the conclusion, and Willing was quickly buried, his passing just as quickly forgotten. Rivas reached San Francisco by boat from Mexico, and there learned of his partner's death. He immediately contacted Mary Ann Willing, Doc's widow, now living in near poverty, and offered her $30,000 for her late husband's estate. She eagerly assented. As evidence of Rivas's character, there is no record of Mary ever receiving anything more than his initial down payment of $300. Rivas was now the sole owner of the Peralta grant, but the only actual evidence he had of its existence was the deed that Doc Willing had recorded in Yavapai County before his death. Willing also had all the carefully manufactured documents that Rivas had put together at the time of his death, and that was now stored in Judge Henry W. Fleury's attic in Prescott. But Rivas was in poor health, not to mention low on funds. He stayed in California, teaching school in Downey in 1875 and 1876. After this, he drifted to the northern part of the state, where he tried his hand at journalism, working as a correspondent for the San Francisco Examiner and for the San Francisco Call. All the time, gathering evidence, or purported evidence, to substantiate the colossal hoax that he was about to undertake. Unaccountably, his fortune suddenly changed in early 1880, which enabled him to begin his travels. In the spring of that year, he arrived in Phoenix in style. He took the stage to Prescott at once, and there, in the attic of Judge Fleury's house, where they had been gathering dust for over 2 years, he found Doc Willing's belongings and his precious documents. Rivas remained in Arizona only long enough to finish his task and then proceeded to Washington, D.C. to inspect certain papers, he testified later. From Washington, he went to Guadalajara in the state of Jalisco, where, posing as an American journalist, he was given access to the archives. When he was finished there, he journeyed on to Mexico City, where, spending money with a free hand, he ingratiated himself with government officials and in return was permitted to examine bundles of ancient royal documents dating back to the time of Philip V of Spain. When Rivas returned to the United States, he was prepared to prove that the great Peralta Grant was originally a gift from the Spanish monarch Philip V to Don Miguel Nemesio Silva de Peralta de Corroboda, the first Baron of Arizonac, and from him descended to his son Jesus Miguel Silva de Peralta de Corroboda, the second Baron, the date of recognition of the grant being set down as January 3, 1758, 14 years after the original promulgation of the royal decree. Down through sons, grandsons, and great-grandsons, Rivas traced the title to his own era, and conveniently, not to the Peraltas of Black Canyon. Now 39, he claimed that he had located a direct descendant of the fabled second Baron of Arizonac, one beautiful Sophia Loretta McCacla Peralta, a young woman who had not yet celebrated her 20th birthday. Rivas promptly made her his wife. Later, Rivas was to go to Spain, where, with the help of the American minister, he was given the freedom of the royal archives, into which he inserted more documents to strengthen his case, removed and destroyed others that were damaging. Now at last, he was ready to make his bid for empire, and he filed an impressive array of documents with the United States Surveyor General of Arizona in Tucson. Believing the land grant to be valid, James M. Barney, the millionaire owner of the Great Silver King Mine, paid Rivas $5,000 for a quitclaim to his property. It sent chills down the spines of the small mine owners and businessmen. If men of the stature of Charlie Crocker, John McKay, and Jim Barney were convinced that the United States would have to declare the Peralta Grant valid, perhaps it was time for lesser men to fall in line. Not only were figures of great wealth backing Rivas, but he was employing the likes of Robert G. Ingersoll and Roscoe Conkling, some of the most famous lawyers in the country, to protect him from his various schemes, such as the Casa Grande Improvement Company and the Salt River Valley Irrigation Company, all of which only existed on paper. Yet it's been stated he received anywhere from $200,000 to as much as $500,000 from these con games. The land grant was by now casting a dark and menacing cloud over that part of Arizona lying within its prescribed boundaries, and the only way in which it could be either validated or invalidated was by the lengthy procedures directed in an act of Congress in 1854 for settling the legality of such grants. It would take 15 years to accomplish the downfall of James Rivas. His scheme finally began to unravel on June 3, 1895, when he appeared to press his claim in the recently established U.S. Court of Private Land Claims in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a Chief Justice Reed presiding. Government experts pointed out that certain alterations to some of the beautifully embellished ancient documents bearing the lead seals of the Spanish crown, which Rivas offered in evidence, could not have been made with the steel pen a century before the steel pen came into use. On June 26th, a week after the trial ended, Chief Justice Reed read the devastating decision. It stated, in part, "The court finds the claim is wholly fictitious and fraudulent, and the various documents on which the same is based are each and all of them forged, manufactured, and have been surreptitiously introduced into the records and archives at Madrid and Seville, and into the records and archives in the city of Guadalajara. and the court further finds that no such person as Don Miguel Nemesio Silva de Peralta de la Corboda ever existed, that the plaintiff, Sophia Loretta Peralta, and her husband and co-plaintiff, James Addison Rivas, are not in any wise related to or connected with the alleged grantee, but they are all and each of them fraudulent and fictitious claimants for said property. Sophia Loretta was subsequently revealed not to be a Peralta or even from Hispanic origins at all, but the illegitimate daughter of an Indian woman and one John A. Treadway of Sherwood Valley, California. Rivas was placed under arrest, charged with conspiring to defraud the government, and after a year of legal wrangling, he was brought to trial. On June 30, 1896, he was found guilty as charged. 2 weeks later, he was sentenced to serve 2 years in a federal penitentiary and fined $5,000. The Lost Dutchman Legend. Because of Whedon's misleading article, the Peralta Land Grant has become so interwoven with the legend and folklore of Arizona that Rivas's mythical Peraltas, not the real ones, color most of the articles written about the Lost Dutchman mine. However, the Peraltas referred to from here on were actual living people residing in Wickenburg and Black Rock, Arizona at the time. Gold was discovered at Sutter's Mill in Northern California in 1849, setting off the first worldwide gold rush. Jacob Waltz, the so-called Dutchman, came to the United States from Germany sometime in 1850 and immediately migrated west, following the tens of thousands of others to the newly opened gold fields. The earliest known written record of Waltz in this country comes from the Los Angeles Census, dated July 24, 1860, a census taken in Sacramento 10 years earlier, dated October 27, 1850, lists a J. W. Walls. Some authors are quick to jump on this as a simple misspelling of his name, thus record of his movement. However, I find this a little too wide of a leap to make without solid foundation. On April 12, 1861, as the Civil War erupted at Fort Sumter, the men in the California gold fields continued their insatiable quest for the yellow metal, seemingly oblivious to anything and everything outside their immediate interest. On July 19, 1861, in the Federal Court for the First District, Los Angeles, Waltz became a naturalized citizen of the United States. This act was not so much out of loyalty to his new country as it was from the common belief among the miners at the time that non-citizens could not legally hold mining claims. In actuality, this wasn't true, but it was widely fostered by the native-born citizens of this country in an attempt to keep immigrants from staking mining claims. In 1862, Henry Wickenburg, a disillusioned 49er, left California and decided to try his luck in the Arizona territories. Riding through the barren countryside, he discovered a large pinnacle of white quartz laced with gold rising from the Arizona desert. This was to become the famous Vulture Mine. Upon news of the discovery, a large number of other prospectors who had failed to become rich in California, Waltz among them, moved to Arizona, seeking another chance at fame and fortune. The Vulture officially opened in the summer of 1863. By September, Waltz had staked and recorded his own first claim, the Gross Lode in the Walker District. However, Waltz's claim turned out to be only a small placer deposit, and in short order, he found himself in need of employment. Jack Swilling, the former Confederate officer and engineer who operated an arastra, or grinding mill, processing ore from the Vulture, hired Waltz, and for the next few years, he worked in and around Wickenburg's mine. Waltz continued his own mining attempts on his free time, managing to stake the Big Rebel claim in the Walnut Grove District in Yavapai County on September 14, 1864, and on January 8, 1865, the General Grant. Again, neither is known to have amounted to much. Steam-powered stamping mills quickly replaced the arastras, dramatically increasing the processing of ore, and Waltz went to work full-time inside the mine. A mile south of the Vulture's two 10-unit stamping mills, the town of Wickenburg gradually rose from a tent city boomtown to an established village with wooden buildings. In 1865, a Mexican named Miguel Peralta, in conjunction with his brother Jesus, established and built a general merchandise store. One of only two such stores in the area, it was visited by most of the miners from the Vulture, including Waltz. Miguel and Jesus had family connections to an elderly Don Miguel Peralta in Mexico, where the main body of the family resided on their ancestral estate in the province of Sonora, near the village of Arizpe. Just months after Miguel's store was established, the unthinkable happened. The Vulture Mining Company had purchased two new 20 stamping mills. Set in place, they were just about to be put into operation when the company suddenly ran out of money due to gross mismanagement of the company's assets. All mining and construction had stopped dead in its tracks by early 1866. The collapse of the company meant total disaster for the town, and for several months, the situation looked bleak. Miners deserted the area, and Wickenburg slowly began its descent into a ghost town. Miguel desperately needed money to keep the business from going under, and leaving Jesus in charge of the store, traveled to the Peralta's ancestral home in Mexico in the hope of raising some much-needed cash. When the Vulture was closed, Waltz was let go with the main body of the miners, not fired for high grading, stealing gold ore, as is often recorded. He also sojourned into Mexico, looking for a new strike. Unfortunately, Miguel Peralta found his relatives rich in heritage only. Don Miguel, Miguel's father or grandfather, had discovered and worked several rich mining claims in Arizona when the territory was still part of Mexico. On Don Miguel's last trip to the mines, he and his expedition were ambushed by Apaches, resulting in the loss of a great number of lives. The fierceness of the attack prompted him to abandon the mines for good and return to his home in Sonora, taking with him what gold the family could carry. This was a disaster for the family in more ways than one. The small amount of gold the survivors returned with was only a fraction of that expected, and the estate soon began to build debts of its own. The original discovery of the Peralta mine is shrouded in mystery. Some accounts claim it was first brought to the attention of Jesuit priests by Apache Indians in the late 16th century. Old mule shoes and an ancient anvil of Mexican origin were discovered near Weaver's Needle around 1900, and there's evidence that gold in large quantities had been once taken out of the superstitions, giving some credence to the theory. The Needle, a prominent rocky formation named for Pauline Weaver, a mountain man, and the first known white man to discover gold in the region, has been the central focus of the Lost Dutchman legend, with many believing the mine lay within sight of it. Peralta and Waltz would have a chance meeting in a small cantina that would change the German's life forever. As the story goes, while playing poker, Miguel caught a gambler cheating at cards and called him on it. Just as the large man was about to take on Miguel, Jacob stepped in on Miguel's side and the man backed down. Other versions claim it was a crooked game of three-card Monty. Afterwards, according to Waltz's personal account, supposedly first related to Julia Thomas by Waltz in 1890, and from a Prescott newspaper, The Prospect, in an article published in 1892, shortly after Waltz died, in a gesture of appreciation, Miguel put forth the proposition of selling a mine to Waltz. Miguel, as well as the ancestral Peralta estate, needed immediate cash to stay solvent, and the shop owner had no desire to chance a trip into the dangerous Apache Indian territories. He knew Waltz from the store and offered the miner the deal of a lifetime. If Waltz would make a trip to the mine and retrieve all the worked gold, hidden in several caches for the Peraltas, whatever gold that still laid within the mine itself would be his. Waltz agreed and was provided with a detailed description of the trails and countryside leading to the mine. Interestingly, Waltz never personally mentioned a map of any kind. The information he was given was strictly verbal, and for an experienced desert rat like himself, perfectly adequate. Waltz carried out his first trip alone with a few pack horses, making an uneventful trip in and out of the superstitions without being seen by the Apaches, and returned, so it's claimed, with about $60,000 worth of gold. Meanwhile, the Vulture Mine, and subsequently the town of Wickenburg, along with Miguel's store's business, were brought back to life by Michael Goldwater and businessman Bernard Cohn, with a loan totaling about $35,000. The mills were finished and up and running in November 1866. By 1880, a total of 80 stamping mills operated around the clock, processing 200 tons of ore and producing $4,000 in gold a day. To actually work his new mine, Waltz realized he needed a partner. His first choice was Jacob Weiser, a carpenter in Florence, Arizona, who is said to have made him one or two dry washers sometime between 1867 and 1870. Whether Waltz and Weiser had a long-time association before this, or if this was just a judgment decision by Waltz, is an unresolved question. Waltz and Weiser reached the southern edge of the superstitions in the spring of 1871 on their first trip to the mine together. According to Waltz's personal account, they proceeded up the first long draw leading to the interior and soon found Don Miguel's marked trail, which led over the top of the main mountain and down a long ridge past a sombrero-like butte into a deep, brush-covered canyon. From there, the trail wound through a small boulder, strewn arroyo, eventually ending at the side of the mine. As the two Jacobs closed in on the site, they heard the sound of someone breaking rocks at the diggings. Spotting what appeared to be three Apaches pounding and sorting ore, Waltz and Weiser immediately opened fire, killing all three men. Upon closer inspection, however, they discovered the men were actually Mexican laborers of Don Miguel's. The men, members of a previous expedition, had slipped away from the ranch in Sonora and had come to the site to mine gold for themselves. Disturbed by their error in judgment, Waltz and Weiser buried the men, then gathered up the sizable quantity of gold worked by them, and started to make their way out of the mountains. But their rifle shots had attracted the attention of the Apaches, and before they could get away, they were attacked. In the running skirmish that followed, the two men became separated. Weiser, Waltz believe, was attempting to make his way toward the friendly Pima Indian villages, but he was never to be heard from again. Waltz, managing to survive unscathed, returned to Florence alone and immediately began to experience problems. When questioned about Weiser's absence, he related his story. Some of the townspeople didn't believe his version of events, and there began a controversy as to the actual facts concerning the carpenter's disappearance. Many of the townspeople suspected and openly suggested that Waltz had simply done Weiser in to keep all of the gold for himself. After a few months, the situation became so intense that Waltz began to fear for his life and was forced to leave the area, eventually resettling in Phoenix. Weiser's body was never recovered, nor is there any record of him surviving the attack. Several stories circulate about Weiser having made it to Pima Village, about him giving a certain judge, or Doc Jack Walker, a map, and how Tom Whedon made a tracing of it. However, these all can be traced back to a single source, Whedon's 1910 article, in which he attempted to incorporate himself and Walker into the Lost Dutchman legend. The fact is, the only person who actually knew what happened to Jacob Weiser was Jacob Waltz. And truth or lie, he stuck to his story right to the end. For the next couple of years, Waltz worked the mine by himself, often disappearing for a month or two at a time. He was sighted on occasion in Tucson, Phoenix, Florence, and Adams Mill in 1872 and 1873, explaining to those who asked that the gold was from what he called one of his little caches. Several times he made his way into the superstitions, but was forced to turn back when he discovered that he was being followed. In 1874, the records of Maricopa County show that he filed on a quarter section of desert land, which a few years later was incorporated into the Phoenix town site. Waltz was in and out of Phoenix, only staying long enough to squander some of his hard-earned gold at the gaming tables. He quickly became famous for his spending sprees and partying. Waltz also liked his beer and became a regular customer of Luke's Brewery. But others in Phoenix had known Waltz some 10 years earlier when he was employed by Jack Swilling at the Vulture Mine. A rumor started that Waltz was fired for high grading, and it's been suggested by some that this was the actual source of his little caches. In Waltz's defense, high grinding, at least at the Vulture, was a curse from day one and a practice the mine owners were never able to stop, even under the threat of death. It was something, quite literally, everybody did. The miners, the foremen, the crew leaders, the freighters who transported the ore to the stamping mills, all picked up a few choice nuggets on the sly. Even the men operating the stamping mills took an occasional five-finger discount. Even though death was threatened, most miners flagrantly caught stealing were simply fired on the spot and sent packing without any back pay due to them. The situation was so bad, in fact, that it was estimated that by the time the Vulture closed on December 8, 1941, just as much gold had been high-graded from the mine as was processed through the stamping mills. The practice was almost encouraged by the local merchants through the years, such as Peralta's store, which gladly took gold in payment, no questions asked. All of Waltz's known ore was made up of different types of quartz. Around 1880, he paid the local shoemaker in Phoenix, Charlie Rudig, with gold in pale yellow quartz for mending his shoes. In 1882, he sold a nugget gold in pink or rose color quartz to one Charlie Myers in Tucson for $1,600. This is the color quartz supposedly found in the Lost Dutchman mine. In 1883, he traveled to San Francisco to dispose of wire gold in black quartz he had shipped by express from Tucson, and the ore he would later give to his nurse, Julia Thomas, in 1890, was gold in white quartz. But Waltz's gold shipments to the federal mints in San Francisco and Philadelphia are also unverifiable incidents in the legend. H. Henry Scheffer III, in his book, The Missing Link, claims these shipments were worth $254,000 by way of Wells Fargo and Company and the old Butterfield stage lines. There are shipping orders and mint vouchers to prove it. However, all records for the San Francisco Mint and Wells Fargo shipping in that city prior to 1906 were destroyed in the earthquake and resulting fire that year that literally burned the entire city to the ground. There are no records at the Philadelphia Mint listing any shipments of gold or silver from a Jacob Waltz at any time. An interesting article appeared in the Arizona Gazette on June 19, 1884. About 10 o'clock a.m. yesterday, word was received that a Mexican by the name of Pedro Ortega had been murdered at the house of Jacob Waltz, a mile southeast of this city, by a man named Celso Grijalva. The matter was turned over to Justice Richards, who, acting as a coroner, summoned a jury and repaired to the scene of the tragedy at 1 o'clock. The Gazette reporter was on hand. He found the body of Ortega lying about 30 feet from the house of Jacob Waltz. His legs and abdomen, from the knees to the breast bone, were perforated with double B shot, the femoral artery on the right side being severed and in itself producing death. there was a mystery about the whole affair. Ortega was shot and killed by a shotgun belonging to Jacob Waltz. That gentleman heard the Mexicans talking loudly and then the report of the gun. He ran to the side of the house where the tragedy occurred and saw the dying man. The assassin evidently ran around the building in the opposite direction, returned the gun to the room and place whence it had been taken, and then sought flight. Waltz did not know, and so testified at the inquest, that his gun had been the instrument of the crime until Deputy Sheriff Rogers appeared on the scene. The only direct testimony was that of Waltz. The murderer is still at large, although officers are in hot pursuit. While the story comes off a bit far-fetched, especially the part about Celso running around the house and returning Waltz's shotgun, the judge and sheriff evidently took Waltz at his word, for nothing more can be found about the incident. How Celso Grijalva, who owned a 160-acre plot of land adjacent to Waltz's, got possession of the shotgun in the first place, and why Waltz didn't even notice the weapon was missing, is left unexplained. During that same summer, Waltz decided to get away and started off into the superstitions alone. This time, three men, Colonel Poston, George McClarty, and Charles Brown, who were determined to discover the mine's location, followed him. The three men returned empty-handed and were later forced to admit that Waltz had managed to elude them in the backcountry of the superstitions after they had followed him to Whitlow's ranch on Queen Creek. Waltz returned from the journey with two small pouches of worked gold, the combined amount being worth just a little over $500. Waltz admitted on his deathbed that he never went near his rich quartz mine after 1884. It was his last known excursion to the mine. What's not widely known is that for the last 20 years of his life, according to a statement made by Julia Thomas after his death, Waltz harbored a deep sense of guilt, feeling he was personally responsible for the death of Jacob Weiser. It's quite possible that every journey to the mine brought back memories of that tragic experience. Now in his 70s, he was getting too old to journey alone into the rugged mountains and was dubious about taking on any new companions, the fear of a double cross always being imminent. Also, the Apache threat, not to mention the growing number of white outlaws, was proving more than a man of his advancing age could handle. Enter Mrs. Julia Thomas. By 1889, Waltz was 78 or 79 years old and no longer the adventurer. He constructed an adobe on his property in Phoenix, a 160-acre plot of land between present-day 7th and 12th Streets, respectively, on the west and east, and Buckeye and Henshaw Roads on the north and south. He fenced off several acres, planted it with alfalfa, and turned to raising chickens and hogs. Jacob lived partly off the livestock, partly from the revenue of wine made from the grapes of his orchard, and just before he died, partly from the donations of friends, never spending what was left of his ore. Selling eggs to a local baker, Mrs. Julia E. Thomas, he gradually became friends with the African-American woman who would eventually serve as his nurse, and her 16-year-old foster son, German-born Reinhardt Reine Petstrach. Julia came to Phoenix from Colorado City, Texas, in the summer of 1883 with her white husband, Emil W. Thomas. She was in her mid-40s. To support the family, Julia opened a bakery located across the street from the Phoenix City Hall, which proved successful enough to eventually partition off the front and add on an ice cream parlor. The bakery needed eggs in quantity, and she gradually became Jacob's best customer. It brought him to her place several times a week and was the beginning of a friendship that lasted for the rest of his life. His friendship with Julia was both kind and generous, and if there was any type of romantic or sexual involvement, there's no evidence of it. Some writers, however, with no documentation, have felt it necessary to interject the sordid notion that she became his mistress. with the sole intention of learning the location of his mine. Julia intermarried, according to her divorce papers, Emil Thomas on December 28, 1880. But Emil proved to be a shiftless character, unknown to Julia, couldn't be bothered with everyday trifles, such as paying the bills. On March 23, 1890, Emil finally deserted Julia and Reinhardt, absconding with all the profits from the store. Julia suddenly discovered her creditors were about to seize her business. Auditors told her the fixtures and stock in the store were worth about $300, but the store's outstanding debts were about $500, along with a separate mortgage of another $300. Waltz, learning of his friend's plight, gave Julia a number of sealed tin cans containing high-grade ore. Records indicate that in April 1890, she cashed in a quantity of gold and white quartz at Goldman & Company's store in Phoenix for a total of about $1,500. She stated to the store owners that Jacob told her to come back for more if the present amount wasn't enough. Then on the night of February 25, 1891, a bizarre situation took place, especially strange for a desert town like Phoenix. The weekly Phoenix Herald reported, Ed Scarborough, Henry King, and others started about 9 p.m. with the boat to rescue Count Dupa H. Tweed and Jake Starr at the latter's place southeast of town. They were on the roof, but unconcerned, as a levee thrown up around the adobe house rendered it proof against the flood. All three men appeared in town this morning as though nothing had happened. Near their places, several adobes, not having been embanked, fell, including those of Beckett Pesquica, Butcher Celso Grahilba, Jake Waltz, one belonging to four Swedes, and two Mexican houses back of Stars. The Salt River, fed by storms in the mountains, unleashed the most extensive flood damage ever suffered in Phoenix and neighboring Tempe. The heavy rains also caused the collapse of a dam on the Hassayampa River at Walnut Grove, about 20 miles north of Wickenburg, releasing a 40-foot-high wall of water that swept downstream, taking 30 lives and destroying a number of commercial buildings and homes located on both banks of the river. Jacob's adobe house crumbled in the similar, though not nearly as high, wake of the Salt River, and most of his personal possessions were swept away in the onslaught of torrential waters. Attempting to rescue his pigs, Waltz became engulfed in the waters, saving himself only by climbing a mesquite tree, where he hung, soaked to the skin, in the cold night air, until rescued by boat the next morning. Shortly afterwards, he developed pneumonia, and with nowhere else to go, was taken in and nursed by Julia. Julia, learning her husband was now in Centralia, Washington, subsequently started divorce proceedings against Emil on August 22, 1891, and was granted a final decree on October 6th. Directions to the Lost Dutchman Mine. On October 25th, Waltz finally succumbed to the complications of the illness that had gripped him for some 8 months. What actually was said in his final hours is up for conjecture, but according to her own account, he told Julia, "The mine is in very rough country. So rough, in fact, that you can be right in the mine without seeing it. Some distance above the tunnel on the side of the mountain is a shaft or incline that is not so steep, but one can climb down. Shelves have been cut into the walls of the vertical shaft, and on each shelf, timbers cut with notches fixed to use as we climbed up carrying our loads. This shaft goes down on an 18-inch vein of quartz that runs several thousand dollars to the ton. This quartz ledge is of the rose quartz variety with a few inches of crystal hematite and quartz on the hanging wall side. The few inches of the hanging wall ore is about one-third gold. The rose quartz is generously sprinkled with pinhead-sized lumps of gold. The ore is rich and easy to remove from the rock, and gold nuggets easily fell out when we tapped the rock with our hammers. There is a cave in a secluded spot in which I hid from when eluding followers. About a mile from the cave, there is a rock resembling a face looking to the east. To the south is a Picacho Butte, or sombrero-like peak. Follow the right of two canyons beyond the peak, but not too far. There's a two-room house in the mouth of a cave on the side of the slope near the gulch. The house is located at the foot of a high bluff and about a mile and a half from the mine. The mine is near the head of the gulch and on the opposite side from the house. The gulch contains many potholes and runs in a north and south direction. Near the head of the gulch is the foundation of an old stone cabin directly opposite the mine. Opposite the foundation of the cabin is a tunnel, well covered up and concealed in the bushes. This mine faces west, and at certain times of year, the setting sun shines through a pass between the two high ridges and falls directly on the mine's covered entrance. According to Julia's own account, sometime during his stay with her, Jacob revealed that a box of gold was still buried under the remains of his ruined adobe, and he wanted her to have it. Riney unearthed the rotting wooden box and transferred the contents, supposedly 48 pounds of gold and white quartz ore, to a clean box and placed it under Waltz's bed, where it remained until his death. On October 25th, Waltz finally succumbed to the complications of the illness that had gripped him for 8 months. When Jacob took a turn for the worst, Julia went for the doctor, leaving Dick Holmes, a mutual friend, and Gideon Roberts, a local tracker, with Waltz. What the dying man said on his deathbed will never be known. The next day, after Jacob's funeral, Julia found the box empty. A lawsuit was filed against Holmes, Julia claiming he stole the gold ore. Holmes, with Roberts as a witness, claimed Jacobs had given him the gold dust moments before he died. The lawsuit was eventually thrown out of court. The gold was never returned. In writing his obituary, the October 26, 1891 Phoenix Herald stated, Jacob Waltz, aged 81 years, died at 6 a.m. Sunday, October 25, 1891, and was buried at 10 o'clock this morning from the residence of Mrs. J.E. Thomas, who had kindly nursed him through his last illness. Deceased was a native of Germany and spent his last 30 years of his life in Arizona, mining part of the time, ranching and raising chickens. His honest, amiable, industrious character led Mrs. Thomas to care for him during his final days on earth, and he died with a blessing for her on his lips. Waltz was buried in the Phoenix City Cemetery, Block 19, Grave 4. Why is the mine still lost? It seems that with such detailed instructions, Waltz's mine should have been located almost immediately. However, even if the directions are accurate, they were rendered useless by a natural event, long overlooked by searchers, the covering of the mine. Many writers have sought a way to explain how the mine may have been filled in or camouflaged. In 1930, an Indian known to the locals as Apache Jack came forward with his version of the events. He claimed that after chasing away Waltz in 1881, the Apaches decided that the only way to keep the white man out of their territory for good was to obliterate all traces of the mine. Apache Jack, supposedly a boy at the time of the incident, told the story of how he and other children and women of his village were set to work filling in the open pit, while the men shifted around larger rocks on the hillside to disguise the area. In other versions of the mine's covering, it's claimed that Waltz himself filled in the pit, exhausting a year's effort to complete the task. While the stories may sound plausible on the onset, they defy some basic logic. In the first place, the Apaches had enough to do just scratching out an existence in the barren and hostile region, much less waste a year moving dirt and rocks around. They would have never pursued such a fruitless venture when it would have been easier to simply kill any white men venturing into their territory. As for Walt's doing it himself, taking into account Walt's age, the amount of work involved, the then antagonistic attitude of the Indians, not to mention the fact that he was known to be in and around Phoenix most of this time, it seems highly improbable he attempted such a lengthy and strenuous venture. Little credence can be given to either the Indian or the Walt's cover-up story. The real answer as to how the mine has eluded its searchers lies in several newspaper articles printed 5 years before Walt's death. Arizona Weekly Enterprise, May 3, 1887. Pinal, Arizona. At 2:35 p.m. Florence time, we had quite a sharp shock of earthquake here. Large pieces of rock were detached on all sides of Picket Post Mountain, which of course rolled to the bottom, raising a cloud of dust, and for several minutes it ascended about the mountain, giving it the appearance of a live volcano. Los Angeles Times, May 4, 1887. The earthquake was very heavy at Fort McDowell, 30 miles east of this city, Phoenix. A large majority of the population rushed into the streets, very much frightened by the strange phenomenon which has never visited this section. Arizona Journal Miner, May 5, 1887. Tuesday's earthquake was felt at El Paso, Deming, Tucson, Yuma, Phoenix, and Fort McDowell. It seemed the heaviest at the latter place. On this bright and sunny afternoon, Fort McDowell and the once thriving mining time of Pinal reported that they were suddenly shaken and shattered by furious vibrations as an earthquake shook the superstitions. From the fort, it was reported that soldiers watched as huge chunks of rock and debris cascaded down the mountain slopes during the brief but violent movement of the earth, sweeping aside everything in their paths. Tons upon tons of rock were strewn over this usually quiet landscape, filling depressions and gorges, shaking buildings off their foundations, and completely changing the topography of the land throughout the mountain range. Within a matter of seconds, the terrain within and around the superstitions changed dramatically. Weaver's Needle was given a facelift by the quake, and around its base are tons of loose rock where, at one time, were part of it. Even a local watering hole was completely covered over. It's quite likely that the open pit mine, the rock resembling a face looking to the east, and the small cave across from the mine collapsed and filled in. The concealment of the lost Dutchman, then, was not the result of intense Apache labor or long hours of toil by the aged miner. It was done at the snap of Mother Nature's fingertips. There's little doubt that Walt's gave Julia his mine with explicit directions for finding it, but Walt's description of the landscape was a reflection of the terrain before the 1887 earthquake. By Walt's own admission, he hadn't visited the actual mine since 1884. The quake, which ran in a direct line from Fort McDowell to Pinal, directly through Weaver's Needle, drastically altered the lay of the land to the extent that it renders even an original map, if there was one, totally useless and valuable today only as a curiosity. Julia Thomas gives the story of the lost Dutchman mine its only real solid foundation. By all accounts, Julia was a hard-working individual and a smart businesswoman. Singly, she had supported herself and her family and paid off most of the debts incurred by her shiftless ex-husband. This said, shortly after Walt's death, Julia Thomas sold the ice cream parlor and set out with Riney in search of the mine. It's highly unlikely she would have risked everything she had worked so hard to attain if she didn't believe there was something out there worth looking for. On her first trip in search of the mine, which lasted about 25 days, she hired two men to assist her. They not only proved to be of little help, but also detrimental to her cause in the long run. Upon returning from the unsuccessful venture, the two men undoubtedly told their friends of certain details that Julia revealed to them, in particular, what landmarks to look for. The news spread like wildfire, and within the year, the secret information contained in Waltz's deathbed instructions was openly printed in local newspapers. After Julia's funds were exhausted, Riney's older brother and his uncle, Herman Petrach, both experienced miners, were summoned from Colorado City, Texas, to look for the mine. In the mountains in the summer of 1892, the two men found and identified a trench on the Black Queen claim at Goldfield as having been dug by Waltz. It was the first mark on the trail to the mine, but this would be their only substantial discovery. In 1894, a prospector by the name of P.C. Bicknell discovered the house in the mouth of the cave, and for a time, the search for the mine was concentrated in this area. Jim Bark and another rancher, Hughes Ward, personally spent several years and over $1,500 scouring the area. Bark is commonly credited with tagging the mine with its now famous title around 1894, after the seemingly endless number of people passing his ranch kept asking him if he knew the directions to the Lost Dutchman's Mine. In 1910, Bark discovered evidence on an apron of volcanic tufa that stretches out from the western wall of the Superstitions, some 3 miles east of the old mining camp of Goldfield, that a ferocious battle between the Mexicans and Apaches, lasting several days, had occurred, validating at least part of Miguel Peralta's story. Curiously, after this discovery was made known, Tom Whedon came forth with a story about how Jacob Weiser survived the 1871 Apache attack, gave a map to one Dr. Walker, and printed his article about the Lost Dutchman Mine, tying it to the ubiquitous Peralta land grant. My research, however, suggests the now famous site of Weaver's Needle was a conclusion reached by Tom Whedon. I had been unable to find a specific reference to the needle by Waltz. The only mention is that of the Picacho Butte, or sombrero-like peak. It's quite possible that the earthquake of 1887 completely changed the look of the original mountain Waltz used for reference. The location that does turn up time and again in my research is the western slopes of hills near Bluff Spring Mountain. I can't help but believe the Lost Dutchman lay somewhere within its close vicinity. In his book, The Missing Link, H. Henry Scheffer III published 16 clues to find the Lost Dutchman mine. Two of them, number 5 and 13, are reprinted here. Clue number 5 involves three red hills. If you pass three red hills, you have gone too far. The Superstition Mountains include several red hills, but there are only two spots where there are three red hills together. One side is immediately north of Bluff Spring Mountain. The other three red hills we will let you find in the Superstition Wilderness. Clue number 13 states, a stone face can be found on the trail to my mine. One's imagination is the only limit to the number of stone faces which can be found or recognized in the maze of rocks found in the Superstition Wilderness. Major stone faces can be found on Bluff Spring Mountain, the north end of the Palomino Mountain, near Fremont Saddle, in Trap Canyon, near Picacho Peak, in West Boulder Canyon, near Willow Springs, in LaBarge Canyon, below the Lower Box, and in many other locations throughout the Superstition Wilderness. Take your choice. Finally, there is Sims Eli's personal account of how in 1911, a ranch hand named Jimmy Anderson discovered an old trail up the east side of Bluff Spring Mountain. The mountain rises abruptly on all sides, and until its discovery, it was believed that no trail led to the top. Anderson, in pursuit of a stray bull, accidentally broke through the dense brush that covered the lower slope and came upon an ancient trail, washed out and badly gullied, but presenting unmistakable evidence that it once had been heavily used. Anderson reported his find to Bark and Eli. Viewing the site firsthand, Eli described the pathway as running at an angle to the right for a considerable distance, then doubling back, and finally zigzagging its way to the top. And the truly astonishing thing was that the trail was deeply worn into the solid rock in many places, and everywhere was at least 3 feet wide. The once free-flowing spring, now only a well situated at the base, and about 2 miles up the mountain for which it was named, has been curbed by a skillfully laid rock wall which stands some 2 feet above the surface and reaches down a considerable depth. A natural corral, several square miles in extent, well-grassed, and with several pools of living water, was discovered on the flat summit of the mountain. It was not only a corral, but a fortress. Half a dozen men armed with rifles could have easily fought off any band of prowling Apaches from the position. Bark and Eli, accompanied by Anderson, explored the trail and believed it was too deeply worn to be the result of erosion alone. They reasoned that at some time in the past, hundreds of beasts of burden, probably mules, had been driven over the trail time after time. But why? The superstitions are almost treeless, save for a few cottonwoods in Fish Creek Canyon. Even mesquite large enough for timbering is not easily found. Bark and Eli had never been able to explain the 40 acres of mesquite stumps they had found on a plateau some 10 miles northeast of the Bark Ranch. The stumps measured from 6 to 10 inches in diameter, and since green mesquite would not burn, they wouldn't have been cut for firewood. Only a mining operation would require such an amount of lumber, the heavy timbers used for shoring up the tunnels. To have hauled the dressed tree trunks over the mountains to a mine pit would have been murderous work, yet it was possible. Any timbers not used in the tunnels could have been used to cover up and camouflage the workings. At the top of Bluff Spring Mountain, they discovered easily identifiable mounds of mule bones and iron Mexican artifacts, further proof of their theory. The torturous work would have broken down any animal. Riney's brother searched for the mine until he died, and Herman continued looking for it up until the start of World War II. Julia made several other fruitless attempts to discover the mine, bankrupting herself. In the end, she was reduced to selling phony treasure maps to make a living. The curse of the superstitions became a popular phrase after Julia died. Destitute, she had to be buried at the town's expense. Riney committed suicide in 1943 after a half century of searching for the mine. Why did these people and hundreds of others like them risk everything to find the lost Dutchman's mine? Jacob reportedly told Julia that he estimated that there was at least $1 million in gold ore yet to be taken out. At today's gold prices, this equals over $100 million.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.